This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and editors about politics. It's Friday, January 13th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. This week, the world got a preview of the new administration in Donald Trump's first press conference and in the testimony of the nominees who distanced themselves from Trump's positions on Russia, Iran, NATO, climate change, the banning of Muslim immigrants and the border wall, and torture. The press conference was dominated by questions and answers right out of a Cold War thriller, which featured a dossier put together by a former British spy. Let's hear what Trump said when he was asked whether Russia had any leverage over him.
If Putin likes Donald Trump, guess what, folks? That's called an asset, not a liability. Now, I don't know that I'm going to get along with Vladimir Putin. I hope I do, but there's a good chance I won't. And if I don't, do you honestly believe that Hillary would be tougher on Putin than me? Does anybody in this room really believe that?
Evan Osnos joins me to discuss Trump's alleged entanglements with Russia and what we learned this week about how the Trump administration will govern. Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm hanging in there, Dorothy. Thanks.
Good. I'm glad to hear it. What do we know now that we didn't know before on this subject of Trump and Russia? Is it all smoke and mirrors, or is there anything substantial here?
I think there's two buckets of things here, and one of the hardest things these days is to separate them. And one bucket is what we really do know for sure, and one bucket is what's alleged. So what we know is that Trump has said many times recently in his press conference and also online in his tweets, as he put it in one tweet, "I have nothing to do with Russia, no deals, no loans, no nothing." The truth is that as his son Don Jr. told a big real estate conference in 2008, quote, "Russians make up a pretty disproportionate cross-section of a lot of our assets." I'm reading it here. He says, "We see a lot of money pouring in from Russia," unquote. So before it was controversial, Donald Trump and his business boasted about how much business they really did have with Russia, going all the way back to his first trip in 1987. You know, he was reported to have a partnership with the Bayrock Group, which is a company that was run by Russian immigrants in the United States. They were going to develop properties in the U.S. And of course, he also famously went to Moscow in 2013 to run a beauty pageant. The full scale of his involvement with Russia is unknown to us because he won't release his tax returns. For instance, one of the things that we don't know, one of the big questions that we will all be looking to discover, and I think the investigative agencies are looking at, is whether or not Donald Trump, for instance, received any important loans at any point during his distressed business history that would have made him, in some ways, captive to Russian interests. That's one of the questions. The other bucket, which I'll mention, is the allegations that we now have all famously heard from this dossier prepared by a former British spy. And much of that remains unverifiable. There are reporters all over the place who have tried to nail it down. They haven't yet. It's not clear yet what they will be able to. Most famously in there is the question of whether or not Russian authorities hold some sort of compromising information like a sex tape on Donald Trump. But yes. I think the more immediate, the more important question is not about the salacious detail. It's about whether or not the U.S. government agencies, the FBI, the CIA, and others, are investigating Trump and his associates for improper contacts with the Russian government during the campaign. That's the crucial question. We've seen some indications that, in fact, it's been reported that they may have issued warrants that would allow them to monitor Russian banks, for instance, to see if they're having contacts with people in Trump's orbit. And I'll leave you with one important detail. Something that I think has been sort of relatively overlooked is that on the Russian side, there has been some mention that they were having contacts with Trump during the campaign. So before it became a big controversial point, the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov told the state-run news agency Interfax that his country had, quote, contacts with Trump's campaign. He said, "Obviously, we know most of the people from his entourage," unquote. The campaign denies that. But what we're dealing with now is a situation where if the U.S. government is investigating Trump and his associates, over the course of the next few weeks and months, we're going to begin to find out more about what those linkages look like.
Trump said that when it came to the hacking, and you can explain that to us in a second, "I think it was Russia." And that was a concession, because he certainly had denied that up until this point.
Right.
But the thing that was striking, he didn't express any outrage about it. And he talked about what we learned from that hacking, and his fury was directed at the intelligence agencies. So unpack that a little bit for us.
The big fundamental question here is, why is Donald Trump, who will soon be our nation's commander-in-chief, the head of the intelligence community in the general sense, the person in charge of defending the Constitution and defending the sanctity and integrity of the United States, why is he sort of shrugging at the very clear evidence that Russia interfered in our election? The one thing we know is that Donald Trump places a very high premium on winning. He says it all the time. If somebody ever questions, for instance, the moral legitimacy of his motives, why he hasn't released his tax returns, as he was asked in the press conference, his answer to that is, well, because I won. Nobody cares about it anymore. You know, the truth is, polls show that 60% of Americans want him to release his tax returns. So he's not stating that point accurately. It's pretty clear that he believes that if he acknowledged that this Russian intervention was not just a moral outrage, but also a threat to national security, then it might in some way undermine the legitimacy of his presidency, which is already sort of fragile at the outset. So I think there's
Pence made that point specifically when he gave his little introduction.
He's hoping to be able to bluff his way through it, and that people will then get caught up in the next great wave of Washington drama, and that maybe this will fade into the background.
I want to shift to the other spectacle this week, the grilling of Trump's nominees to various posts. Here's Rex Tillerson being questioned by Marco Rubio on Wednesday.
Is Vladimir Putin a war criminal?
I would not use that term.
Well, let me describe the situation in Aleppo, and perhaps that will help you reach that conclusion. In Aleppo, Mr. Putin has directed his military to conduct a devastating campaign. He's targeted schools, markets, not just assisted the Syrians in doing it. His military has targeted schools and markets and other civilian infrastructure. It's resulted in the death of thousands of civilians.
Tell us a little bit about the political ramifications of that confrontation and what we're likely to see as this nomination goes forward.
Well, part of this was a reflection of what a strange moment we are now in which traditionally the Republican Party has been the source of the sort of greatest vigilance and defense against Russian foreign policy. This goes all the way back to the Cold War. And so Marco Rubio was playing, in some ways, the traditional role of the Republican Party there, asking a cabinet nominee to denounce Russian intervention in Syria. The oddity, of course, is that he was doing it to a fellow Republican.
So what about Tillerson and his own ties to Putin? He does have a close personal friendship with the man.
Yeah, Tillerson has longstanding business interests. He, as CEO of ExxonMobil, had very close relationships with the Russian government. As a lot of people know, he received what's known as the Order of Friendship from the government. Now, I think some of that's been sort of people have made a lot of fun out of it. They tend to give away the Order of Friendship fairly frequently, it turns out. But it is a measure of the fact that Rex Tillerson and Vladimir Putin have a long-running relationship that puts him into a unique position relative to prior Secretaries of State. You know, one of the unique things about the Secretary of State job is that you are, in a sense, a kind of roving spokesman for American values, meaning that you stand up for not just policy, but the underlying commitments to human rights and democracy. As a CEO of ExxonMobil, he was trained over the course of decades to recuse himself from these kinds of normative values questions. Whenever the question came up about human rights, he would say, that's not the business I'm in, more or less. He would say, my job is to represent the shareholders of ExxonMobil. He's now being asked overnight to reinvent himself with zero government experience into being somebody who can be an impassioned, eloquent envoy on behalf of American democracy. And the question is whether he's capable of that. You know, we're dealing with a slate of nominees who have almost a historic level of unfamiliarity with government. Very few of them have served in senior positions, and we're beginning to see some of that on display during the nomination hearings.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Another interesting moment this week was the testimony of James Mattis, Trump's nominee for defense secretary, who does have experience in the military. You know, it's interesting. A few weeks ago, journalists were just wringing their hands about Mad Dog Mattis. Now they're relieved at his relative sanity based on what he was saying yesterday. Our own John Cassidy just posted a piece asking whether he can save America from Trump.
Yeah, I would say probably the only source of agreement in Washington, D.C. this week is on the visible decency of James Mattis. For the moment, we will see how this plays out. But I should say that we haven't even gotten to Inauguration Day. And around town here in Washington, where I live, there is already a lot of talk about whether Mattis is at odds with other members of the Trump foreign policy and national security establishment. For instance, Michael Flynn. James Mattis outranked Flynn when they were in the military. Now Flynn, as national security advisor, is very close to the president. So it's not clear. There's, you know, I was with a group of people the other day who were taking bets on whether or not James Mattis or Michael Flynn will leave the administration first. What this tells you is that there is going to be a lot of turmoil within the closest ranks of Trump's associates on national security, not just for personality reasons, but also because they have deep underlying differences of policy and experience.
Getting back to the press conference for just a minute, Pence and Trump eviscerated BuzzFeed for publishing that intelligence dossier with all of the unsubstantiated rumors about Trump, which he, of course, instantly described as fake news. Well, he had a point about that. And BuzzFeed's decision enabled him to put the press on the defensive and thus avoid the kind of scrutiny that they would have liked to subjected him to. So what about that?
I think, you know, there are other news organizations were in some ways rightly troubled by BuzzFeed's decision to post this unverified report that had been commissioned by Trump's political opponents, conducted certainly by a former intelligence agent, but really it was not journalism. This was not something that had been subjected to the kinds of basic tests that we do every day in our jobs, which is to test the credibility, the legitimacy, the validity of these sorts of things.
He initially claimed that this had been leaked by the intelligence agencies, which was part of this vendetta he seems to have against the intelligence community. And that's just not the way it works. And he had to walk that back a little bit, too.
News organizations had their objections to posting the BuzzFeed report because it makes it harder than for sort of fully mature, realized journalism to be taken seriously. But that being said, I think that it is a mistake to focus too much on the intramural debates within journalism about what is right or not right to publish, when in fact that's very much Donald Trump's agenda here, is to say, pay no attention to what has been raised, very serious concerns by the heads of the intelligence agencies, and instead let's point a finger at CNN and at BuzzFeed for its decision here. Not to say that one is legitimate and one is not, but let's not lose focus here, which is that the real story here is that you may have the FBI and the CIA investigating the president-elect.
Let's also not forget President Obama's farewell address on Tuesday night in Chicago. Let's just hear a little bit from that.
Our Constitution is a remarkable, beautiful gift, but it's really just a piece of parchment. It has no power on its own. We the people give it power. We the people give it meaning with our participation and with the choices that we make and the alliances that we forge. Whether or not we stand up for our freedoms, whether or not we respect and enforce the rule of law, that's up to us. America's no fragile thing, but the gains of our long journey to freedom are not assured.
So Obama was calling there on the American people to resist lawlessness. Valerie Jarrett actually was interviewed this week, and she denied that he was addressing some of these remarks directly to Donald Trump. However, I think it's impossible to escape the conclusion that he was. And what about this invocation of the Constitution and how the Republican Party, which is already itself in the throes of trying to come to terms with some of the worries here about the Emoluments Clause and other matters?
If you look back at previous presidents' farewell addresses and you look, for instance, for the number of times that they mention the word democracy, it almost never comes up. It comes up in sort of ritual routine references to the glories of democracy. But this was something very, very different. This was Barack Obama calling upon his people to reinvigorate their commitment to the very basic essence of American government, you know, the sort of the virtues and the fragility of democracy. That's an extraordinary thing for an outgoing president to do. I mean, the fact that he felt compelled, that he looked out over the country and saw what he's described as these basic threats to democracy, whether it's, you know, the cracks in our solidarity or the racial divisions or the retreat from facts and reality or this kind of sort of deep malaise and apathy. All of those things, he said, are a threat to things that I think many of us would have assumed a year or two ago were settled questions about what kind of government we're going to have and what sort of country we want to be. So he never had to mention the name Donald Trump for his message to be very clear, which is that it will fall upon every citizen to maintain their vigilance and to maintain their commitment to making sure that the president and the administration are following the law. And this is going to become an issue quite soon. I mean, there is an open, raging constitutional question about whether or not and in what ways a president can conduct business and in what ways a president can be subject to impeachment for doing so. You know, a couple of months ago, there were probably not more than five people in Washington who could spell the word emolument. Now it has become...
I know. Everyone rushed to Google it.
Exactly. I mean, the Emoluments Clause, as we now all know, is this feature of the Constitution that basically means that a president can receive nothing of material benefit from a foreign government. And whether he is the financial beneficiary of a hotel company, for instance, can have foreigners staying in that hotel, foreign governments, that's one of the questions that's going to have to be examined. And his side is saying that he is able to do it, but there's a pretty strong case from constitutional lawyers who say if he does that, he's going to open himself up to immense exposure and vulnerability. And I think we're at the very beginning of this process.
Yeah, and we haven't even really gotten into that in any detail. He said this week, I have a no-conflict situation because I'm president. And you know what he means. And he's sort of right about that legally. But talk about that in terms of what he has and hasn't done in terms of distancing himself from his business interests.
A lot of voters, I think, if you'd asked them 6 months ago, would have assumed that if Donald Trump managed to win the presidency, that suddenly his businesses would seem a lot less important to him, and he would figure out a way to pretty quickly walk away from them. So, I mean, he's by some definitions, a very wealthy man. And in fact, he's done something very, very different. He has not tried to sell off his interests or tried to create a blind trust, which would mean that he doesn't know what his own interests are. That's what, you know, for instance, Michael Bloomberg did when he was mayor of New York. No, Trump has tried to come up with something different, which would allow him to still basically profit from his companies, but also not have day-to-day management. He said in his press conference that he was going to create a trust that would be run by his sons and that he would not have any day-to-day control. Any government ethicist would tell you, and they did in the right after his announcement, that this is not in any way a legitimate way to remove conflict of interest. He will still be very much conflicted. To take a really basic, obvious example, if he has a business in Panama, for instance, as he does, that gives him between $1 and $5 million a year for having his name on a hotel, the question is when he is then faced with a decision that might make the Trump name unpopular in Panama, if he has to do some foreign policy decision, well, is he going to make a decision based more on trying to preserve his revenue stream than on trying to preserve the interests of the American public? It's not as if Trump is telling us, look, I don't know, I haven't really looked seriously at it, but I'm going to do everything I can to try to remove myself from my businesses. He hasn't done that. What he has said is we've looked at it and we think that I can't be legally vulnerable for conflict of interest, and therefore I'm going to do this step that is much below what government ethicists would have expected him to do. And that puts him at tremendous exposure.
Thanks so much, Evan. To be continued.
Thanks, Dorothy.
Evan Osnos is a staff writer and the author of Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. This has been The Political Scene from The New Yorker. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app. You can find more political analysis and commentary on NewYorker.com or on the New Yorker Today app, a great way to read The New Yorker on your mobile device, available at no extra charge from the App Store or at NewYorker.com/today. Tell us what you thought of this podcast. Rate and review The Political Scene on iTunes. This podcast is produced by Alex Barron and Jill Duboff for NewYorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.